there is definitely a role for us to grow subscriptions. It just might be leveraging the talent of our newsroom, showing off what we can do, and then guiding you back to paid subscription, more traditional platforms.
Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Media Voices, the media-focused podcast that brings you all the news and views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And that quote you just heard is from Theodora Lalludis, podcast editor for The Telegraph. We spoke about her role, growth in The Telegraph's podcast portfolio, and her approach to commissioning.
We know that there's not all that much to look forward to at the moment, so we do want to announce that we're going to be doing a live special in a couple of weeks. Not, as we wanted, in front of an auditorium full of people, but we're going to be doing it digitally on Twitch. The benefits are you'll be able to interact with us, ask us questions, and you'll be able to see our lovely faces live as
is
we
discuss.
Is that
a benefit?
It will be when I spend a couple of hours in makeup.
I have a face for podcasts, it has to be said.
I once, so when the last time I had a professional photo taken, the woman very kindly said, I've got to use a lot of powder for your head. which obviously put me in the right frame of mind to be smiling down the camera lens.
I did a live webinar once with two guys, and the makeup artist did the stuff, and the makeup artist did the stuff, and when it came to the end, she said, okay, I'll take it off. They were like, screw that, we're going to the pub.
Anyway, we're going to be looking at how publishers are getting on in the current coronavirus crisis, and basically how they're innovating new business models. Lots to look forward to there.
So what date are we going to be doing that?
Thursday the 9th of April at 2 p.m. GMT.
It's not GMT anymore, it's BST.
Oh, for goodness sake, BST. we've lost an hour of our lives. Yeah, although
you've got to reckon, people listening to this podcast, that happens to them every week.
It does also mean, though, that the isolation has been shortened by an hour.
Oof.
Okay. Hooray.
Good news.
As you can tell, isolation has properly set in for all of us now. So let's get back to the matter at hand, which is the media. This first story actually gave me quite a lot of hope for subscription models. Esther, why don't you take us through what's going on with this?
Firefox and Scroll have teamed up to test a new model. So Scroll, people may have heard of it. It launched at the end of January, and it's basically this quite nifty little subscription tool that offers ad-free access across a number of publisher sites. You know, you go to places like BuzzFeed, Business Insider, Slate, Vox. And basically what happens, you pay a small amount per month, and that monthly fee gets divided between publishers depending on how much time you spend on their sites. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but it actually works out that individual user drives more revenue than the average ad impression, and it can be up to 40% more that you get per user if they're paying the subscription thing.
Is that Scroll's figures?
It's Scroll and a couple of partner publishers. And what Firefox has now done is that they're now partnering with Scroll to launch the Scroll product across Firefox's sites and browsers. It's quite a good deal for Scroll, I think, because they basically get access to all of Firefox's users. But I mean, Firefox has always kind of been leading the charge in terms of browser privacy and things. So this obviously really appeals to Firefox as something to be promoting.
Yeah, how does this work with paywalls, though?
Not entirely sure. So they've not released details of how it works across sites.
I mean, if I've already paid whoever, the New York Times, and then I'm paying again for this, why would I do that?
The selling point is, well, look, you're not just getting it to this one site, you're getting it across this raft of other sites as well, who you're unlikely to have subscriptions.
Yeah, you won't have most subscriptions
of them,
at all.
Yeah, most of them don't necessarily have that anyway.
I think the people this is trying to target, and I don't know how big a user segment this is, it's those people that use an ad blocker because they cannot stand the state of the internet. But people who kind of feel bad about using an ad blocker, they know it takes revenue away from people. So it's this kind of way that you can actually pay and you are a more valuable user to these publishers, but you then get a better user experience in return.
That's me. You're describing me.
And I mean, yeah, the membership is really good value. I think it's $2.50 a month.
Oh, that's
and
cheap.
Yeah, exactly. With Firefox, they're offering a free 48-hour trial and like a 50% discount. But the tests they've done so far, they've done a few tests in the US, and this product is only available in the US at the moment. 18% of those free trial members actually converted to full paying members.
Nice.
Which, given you're normally looking at about 3-4%, is really, really good.
I absolutely see the point in this. It's just a smart ad block.
It's consensual ad removal.
This is this lives and dies on the publishers that adopt it, doesn't it? It needs that totally critical mass, and it needs there to be some big names there as well.
Well, I also think it does, this needs to get to a point when a critical mass of people are using it. And I think Firefox, it becomes worth publishers signing up to it because...
What's Firefox's share of the browser market, though? It can be huge.
It's just under 9%, which obviously is, dwarfed by Chrome, but so is everything. Yep. It's bigger than Internet Explorer, though, thank God.
Actually, it's bigger than I thought.
But where Firefox have traditionally gone in the past, the other browsers have followed. You think about the Firefox are the ones were the first ones out the door with the cookie, third-party cookie disabling. Safari and Chrome have followed suit less than 6 months later.
Safari's a goodie.
You got to imagine though, this makes conversations with advertisers a little bit, and sort of like ad tech providers a little bit trickier. If you're saying, well, look, we are basically saying to potential members, the optimum experience is no ads.
Okay, but if you look at what advertisers are doing at the moment, the number of them that are, you look at block lists, you look at people that have pulled the ad spend, you can't be dependent on them anymore. You know, boo-hoo.
Now,
Esther, the positive member of the Media Voices team, not.
No, I agree. I mean, the whole thing about block lists recently has been insane. You saw that really good article that was basically just like, for the love of God, at this time more than ever, please do not use block lists when you know that 90% of what people are reading on our site is around coronavirus.
I think there was a BuzzFeed article I have to link to that actually put the numbers for how much BuzzFeed have lost in revenue through block lists for coronavirus.
Well, did you see the Newsworks thing? Newsworks has put this thing out with basically representing all the papers saying... at this time, you're blocking this amazing journalism. And if you forget the fact that they actually mentioned the Sun and the Express and the Star, then yeah, absolutely.
All right. So, Esther, is this effectively a trial, or is this a new product that has officially launched?
It's a kind of new model they're testing. That's how they've described it. But I think given that Scroll has been in the works for a long, long time. They worked on it for about 2 or 3 years before they launched in January. It seems to have gone down very well. The partnership is a test, but I can see at the rate that it's going that Firefox will almost certainly keep it permanent and roll it out to more people outside the US.
And talking about subscriptions and membership revenue, Slate has launched a metered paywall to draw more membership revenue from its readers. So it's launched its membership program Slate Plus 6 years ago, but it's now putting up that paywall to drive more members to it.
But one of the things with Slate is they kind of try different stuff all the time. And it seems to me like, and maybe this isn't fair, that's because the core stuff's not quite working.
Okay, what do you mean?
That they're just not getting the revenue they need because they've tried, they kind of pivoted to podcast, didn't they?
So the Neiman Lab story had a bit of a different take on this. So they've got, as far as I understand, Slate Plus has got quite a few gated podcasts that you only get if you're a Slate member, and Slate podcasts do really, really well. So that's done amazingly well at converting people through to Slate Plus. And they've basically said that their audio audience are really, really loyal, really engaged with the membership. But they don't really do a lot with the readers, just the people that maybe don't listen to podcasts but just come to the site to read. So the Neiman Lab article says that actually their audio currently accounts for more than half of Slate's membership revenue. And they basically just want to try and balance that a bit more and capture a few more of those really loyal readers who aren't audio listeners.
They're doing okay. They've got 60,000 people paying them money every month. So they're doing okay. I don't know. It's a weird one for me at this time. So Gardaí have introduced a membership scheme and they've been very straightforward about that, saying that the coronavirus thing moved that forward. This is a weird time to restrict access to content, don't you think?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that they're not stopping it though, are they? It's they're trying to say to these people that are constantly on the site, we're not getting money from this content, we need money from you.
Okay.
The reason I think the timing's weird is because now is not, like, people are really struggling for money right now because of coronavirus. So,
and they were really early into podcasts and they went at it, you know, they did it really well. They did some great stuff. They were one of the first websites that really brought a true magazine ethos online. They really did.
They were one of the first websites.
Hmm.
And then talking of launching things at odd times, as Peter's mentioned, Galdem have launched their membership scheme, which we wish them all the best with. We will pop a link to it in the newsletter, but what we're going to do is discuss it in our kind of Publishers in a Pandemic special in 2 weeks. So tune in then if you want to hear more about Galdem's membership scheme.
And now our news in brief. Esquire's trimmed its print editions to 6 issues a year, down from 8 last year and 10 the year before. It's all about advertising revenue slipping. Hearst president Troy Young said the reduction is not coronavirus related, and I believe him. There's a trend there. And he's always been very focused on the digital side of things anyway, so I think he's planning to put more money into the digital side of the publication.
Yeah, certainly. Go back and listen to our episode with Alan Williams about Esquire specifically, and you can see that that's very much what they've been planning to do for a very long time. It was all about kind of the primacy of the brand itself rather than of the print medium.
Yeah.
And some good news. Patreon, which are they're kind of a... How would you guys describe Patreon?
They're a sort of membership enabler. They're sort of like the PayPal, but for memberships.
The what?
Yeah. So if you've got somebody that creates stuff you like, you can kind of sign up to a monthly donation to them through Patreon. And that ranges from organizations to individuals to like podcasters to artists, all sorts. Well, one of the questions coming has been, with coronavirus, how much are creators losing out on this? And it turns out actually not at all. So Patreon have released a study this week, and they said that average new patron growth is up 36.2% in March compared to February. And they've said from this that the message from the data is clear, membership works. So people are basically turning to support individual creators and things in time of crisis, which is nice.
That is nice. That is nice. I think that speaks to, you know, kind of the proficiency of the individual creators in actually getting that message across that they need support, you know, more than it is about membership. Because it seems to me that what he's saying is the message from the data is clear, coronavirus works.
Nothing like a global pandemic to boost your membership sales.
And some bad news now, though. BuzzFeed is cutting pay for its employees as the publisher attempts to weather the pandemic. So staffers in the lowest pay bracket are going to get a 5% reduction, while execs at the top are going to take up to a 25% pay cut.
Okay, the one thing I'll say about this, obviously pay cuts are really terrible, but if you're going to do it, this is a good way around to do
it. I agree with that. I think they've been on this. Jonah Peretti's actually said he's not taking a salary, which I'm sure, you know, he won't be starving, but you know, it's a nice gesture.
Yeah, it is. It's always appreciated when this happens, when you know it's weighted so that the people who are earning more can afford it a little bit more. Yeah. Take that pay cut. It's nice to see.
I think you saw some of the kind of reaction from BuzzFeed staff was quite positive in the way that they'd handled this and communicated it. So well done, BuzzFeed. Woo-hoo. I'll probably get loads of emails now saying you didn't see any feedback from me. I am furious. There's lots of places making donations to support publishers. Twitter has given $1 million to the Committee to Protect Journalists and the International Women's Media Federation. These are good stories. I saw a thing from Casey Newton about, you know, is this the moment that the tech backlash stops and tech actually starts to become human again?
I've seen alternative perspectives on that suggest that the tech clash has stopped and we've basically just stopped caring about the privacy issues now because we're bored and want to go back on Facebook.
But it's not just that. It's the fact that they've made advertising free to health organisations and governments, that they've put coronavirus information at the top of the feed. They've just done a bunch of stuff.
But like, maybe that's true... But you know what I mean? Like, maybe that's true for a couple of... I think what Twitter's doing particularly is really, really good. We like Twitter. No, absolutely not. As if one swallow doesn't make a summer, and now we can't just forget all these kind of abuses or even think that, this is going to be a 180 when things go back to normal.
No, and I'm pretty sure Casey Newton wasn't arguing that, and I'm not arguing that. But what he's saying was, is this the starting point of them being more human?
I'll believe it when I see it.
Oof.
I feel like this is a big argument for another time.
Okay.
Coronavirus has actually caused a dip in podcast listening. So everybody now wants to listen to the news on TV and online, and they are basically not listening to true crime podcasts anymore. I think a lot of podcasts are seeing about around a 10 to 15% dip across listening figures.
Yeah, I was going to say one of the things is the commute
Yeah, for sure. I wonder what this means for a company like, say, Slate.
Well, maybe that's why they've launched the membership scheme for readers.
There's a hand grenade to throw in the room. Pain continues. Oh, God, man. This is like, can we have a happy news roundup at some point?
We're in the middle of a pandemic. We cannot have a happy news roundup, Peter.
No, to like talk about puppies or something, or kittens. I don't know. Pain continues for local tales across Europe. Reportedly, some local papers in Germany have seen an 80% fall in ad spend. Jesus, man, that's a lot. Yeah, there's a puppy.
You're welcome. I just pasted that in the doc for you. And it's not exactly news per se, but there is a very well argued piece from Colin Morrison on Flashes and Flames, contending that all media, not just the events-based ones, need to reset as a result of this. And I highly advise you go read it, because it's very interesting and it just makes me jealous that I didn't write it before he did.
This week I spoke with Theodora Laloudis, podcast editor for The Telegraph. With a growing podcast portfolio, we spoke about her job in an expanding team, growth in The Telegraph's podcast offering, and how she commissions shows with the paper's journalists.
I feel like telling you about being a podcast editor at The Telegraph this month is different to me telling you about being a podcast editor at The Telegraph last month. To the month before, to the month before, to the month before, because it is a job that's changing, in a department that's changing, in a newspaper that's changing, in times that are changing, and times that are busier and busier, it seems. But maybe that's just the podcasting world.
So it's all about the change.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. We went from being a team of zero when I started at The Telegraph 2 years ago, and the audio team was mainly freelance producers, up to a team of what we are now currently, which is two, or soon to be two. We're in a bit of a gap in between other producers, so I'm currently a team of one, but hopefully by the time this podcast comes out I won't be as stressed, because we'll be a team of two.
So before we talk about what you actually do, how did you get to the point of being the podcast editor at The Telegraph? What's your sort of career trajectory at The Telegraph?
Yeah, so I started working in radio. That was my first job. I was a newsreader on local radio. They got Radio Jackie in Southwest London and North Surrey. So I really learnt the ropes on local radio, and was started on work experience and was put on air on day four or something with huge imposter syndrome, but really, really good experience. And my aunt found it very exciting because she lives near Tolworth, and she would get the odd shout out when no one was listening on a Sunday 3 a.m. shift.
Got to keep the family happy.
So yes, I started in local radio, ended up working there part-time over my journalism masters, then went a bit doolally and moved to Paris to work in TV news for a couple of years, at France 24 doing international TV news. It's really the opposite of what I do now, because for that we were constantly live and constantly on air, whereas obviously now this is as live as it gets, this interview. Yeah. I really don't do anything that's live anymore. So I think if you can do the stress of 24-hour rolling news, you can do the stress of, or the lack thereof, of podcasting. So,
so this is an easy gig for you then?
Different. I won't give you that. It's different. It's less fast-paced. Although turnarounds can be quick. Certainly when I was producing the Brexit podcast, that tested me. But yeah, different. I would say there's plenty of pressures, not least being a small team. But yeah, different. So I was in Paris having a lovely time, but a very different time. And then eventually decided I wanted to come back to London. I was always really interested in British politics and ended up being put on covering loads of British politics, but in Paris, which just seemed a bit silly since I'd grown up in London. I just thought, why am I doing this from Paris? Why aren't I in Westminster? So moved back to England and was looking for something both where I'd have the opportunity to work in political journalism and also move back into the audio space, which was my kind of first love. And this job came up at The Telegraph, which was called broadcast journalist 2 years ago. And broadcast journalist means something really different everywhere. This particular role was writing, presenting and producing news bulletins for flash briefings. So it was, so it was quite new, a space, the smart speaker space. And I sort of saw The Telegraph and Smart Speakers, and I just thought, oh, that's interesting. It's not really what I'd expect from a very traditional, or so I thought, news publication. And they took on two of us to do it full time. So we would run these flash briefings. So basically four 3-minute news updates to go on smart speakers and podcast apps 4 times a day, staffed by freelancers the other 2 days a week. Did that for a year, really got to know loads of journalists around the company because I would forever be dragging them into the studio. Anyone who's worked in a daily print paper knows that that is not the easiest thing when people are on daily deadlines and I'm there saying, I'm sorry, but have you heard of a flash briefing and do you want to come on it and do it 4 times a day? Please come in today and this afternoon. And so, but it was a really good way to get to know the journalists and I guess in hindsight to build up their trust a bit. And then that job ended up being staffed by freelancers and because they decided after a year to move me into podcast production. I had already been producing our Brexit podcast, which was called Chopper's Brexit Podcast. Yep. It's now called Chopper's Politics, yep, on the side for 6 months. And I was a complete podcast addict. And the good thing about working in audio is that you can spend all day, every day with headphones on and everyone thinks you're doing work. So I was listening to loads of podcasts, mainly outside of the job. And I...
Research,
exactly. You've got to keep up with the competition. And then I became a full-time podcast producer, our first full-time podcast producer in January 2018. I was reporting to the then podcast editor, and then he very kindly vacated his job in last November. So I very luckily got bumped up and I'm thrilled to now lead our small but perfectly formed podcast department.
Excellent. So in terms of what you do day to day, you know, what is the podcast editor's role?
So a lot of it involves developing shows with journalists around the newsroom who are often very experienced on print, but not very experienced on audio. So they might come to you with an idea. In fact, they often come to you with an idea. I'm getting pitched around a show a day at the moment, which is keeping me nice and busy. And yeah, we go through the idea and decide if and how it would work in audio, how feasible it is, how much it would cost, whether we'd need to take on help from a production company or for some freelancers. And then if we decide to go ahead with the show, I'll work with the commercial team to see if we might be able to find some sponsorship, or we'll decide that this show isn't appropriate for sponsorship and we'll fund it ourselves and use it as a bit more of a brand grower. And then I do all the production side of things as well. So I'll produce the content, decide alongside the presenters what we're going to feature in each show. I'll edit the show along with the help of some freelance editors. And upload it and then take it straight through to the promotion side of things as well. So I work heavily alongside our social and website teams to make sure that the content is promoted around the website and on social. So it's really taking the show from its birth to its end. Yep. But then obviously we have the weekly ongoing shows as well, which keep us nice and busy on the production side of things.
So what does the Telegraph's podcast portfolio look like right now? You know, you do sound busy. What sort of size how many podcasts are you talking about?
Okay, so we've got 3 shows that run every week. We've got Chopper's Politics, which is does what it says on the tin, political show, Audio Football Club, which is our weekly football news show, and Brian Moore's Full Contact, which is our weekly rugby news show, headed up, surprise, surprise, by former England hooker Brian Moore. So we've got those 3 weekly shows. They run all year round. We have some freelance producers who come in. I do the rest of them. And then we have our daily 2-minute news briefing, which is produced twice a day. And that's just a kind of micro bulletin, news bulletin. It's also a smart speaker skill. So those are your weekly, your daily. And then we also have kind of big, more ambitious series, which take us more out of the studio, more crafted narrative storytelling. And we tend to run series of 6 episodes, maybe a few times a year. So we're
running, like the Crossfire, the Trump-Russia story?
You took the words right out of my mouth. We're running one at the moment called Crossfire, which is, as you said, it's the UK's involvement. It kind of tells the untold story of the UK's involvement in the Trump-Russia scandal.
So those are quite different. You know, the Choppers podcast, the football podcast, and the rugby podcast are kind of... they're kind of ongoing, almost news driven, whereas the other ones are almost documentary format. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So the weekly ones that run throughout the year are largely studio based, although we do record Choppers Politics in a pub in Westminster. Nice. But the idea is the same. We're sitting around a table and we have journalists and pundits talking. So whereas the kind of narrative series, we'll call them the documentary series, they are much more work in terms of, you know, you might spend, Crossfire, we've spent the past year on it. Obviously, there have been some months that have been more work intensive than others. But yes, they can take a long time to really craft a story. And then also, they're much more heavily sound designed. So you'll have a lot of archive news clips coming in there, music. Sometimes we'll commission music to be written for the show. So yeah, they're much more work, but more satisfying in a way, in that you've really crafted a story and you've really got something often quite evergreen to show at the end of it, whereas our other shows, you're really looking for immediate reaction and analysis.
So is that the real benefit from the Telegraph's point of view, that it's got a shelf life that a weekly doesn't have? You can actually, it can sit there for however many months and people will just keep coming back to it?
Yeah, it's definitely that plays a role. I'd say the other thing is that our journalists are really good at crafting stories and that they don't often get a chance to do that sometimes in their daily roles. So you know what it's like with daily news deadlines. Yeah. I'm trying not to use the word churn, but you are go, and sometimes they do have these bigger stories that require more analysis, that even more than a long read sometimes. So it's one of the only, I would say probably the only medium in which they can really go very in-depth, unless they are doing a very long read, but that we don't publish as many of those.
I think that's interesting because it's just, you know, we talk about what podcasts can do that print can't do or what online can't do or whatever, and that's definitely one of the things that I think people are seeing, is that idea that you can take these serialised approaches and you can really get inside a subject.
Yeah, totally. And capitalise on their amazing contacts. You know, they're speaking to different people every day for different stories, and to be able to bring those all together into a series that leaves the reader kind of feeling like they fully understood the story is quite satisfying, I think.
So you're saying you're getting pitched almost one a day or whatever. Are the print guys, or are the print guys probably not right anymore because it's not just print, is it? But are they sort of text-based journalists really getting behind the audio side of things?
Yeah, there's been a real shift whilst I've been at the company. I think it's a mixture in terms, I mean, you know, we're all listening to more and more audio. So you can imagine the journalists going home and thinking, well, hang on, I could do that myself.
Yeah.
I think it is that the space is growing. I think a part of it is that it's the cool new thing. Maybe video were being pitched, loads of stuff a couple of years ago. And I think it is just that it's a chance to slow things down a bit in such a fast-paced newsroom, and they just see it as an opportunity to do something a bit different and to reflect on things a bit more once a week.
Yeah. When you're being pitched these ideas, is there a single thing that you're looking for, like a launch strategy or something that defines a Telegraph podcast?
So I'm definitely looking for something that a Telegraph listener would be interested in. I mean, you're not going to make a kind of Radio X podcast for a Telegraph listener. Although, I'd like to see you try, actually. Although our listenership does trend, as is completely usual across the industry, but our listenership does trend, from what we know, a bit younger than our readership. So it is a bit different. But, yeah, definitely something that a Telegraph consumer or the Telegraph audience would be interested in. So, you know, we're really big on politics. We're really big on business. We're really big on the royal family, our kind of key topics. So, yeah, I'd keep the brand in mind. Then I'm looking for something that we can do particularly well. You know, there's so much competition out there. We're not the best placed people to do a daily deep dive show with our small but perfectly formed team.
Yeah.
We'll leave that to the New York Times. But
who's got about 20 people working on that show?
I know. If some of them would like to come and work alongside me, they're more than welcome. But, you know, that's how it is at the moment, and we're not best placed to do that. But we are really strong on political analysis. So I'm always open to hearing a new way of covering that, and something ambitious and interesting from a voice that I think the listeners would be interested in.
One of the Telegraph sort of stated business aims is to grow its subscriber base, its digital subscribers. Mm. Quite aggressive targets for that. Is there a role for podcasts in that sort of bigger business aim?
Actually, you brought up something that I definitely should have said, that we are always looking for shows that fit in with our kind of wider offering. You know, if a show has a really good place on our website in a way in which we could present that show really well in the context of the Telegraph website, you know, we might be running a campaign around it, or we might have a series of long reads in which we could embed it. That's always a big plus too. In terms of the subscriber offering, yeah, definitely. I think that's twofold. First of all, we really want listeners to get to know our journalists a bit better, maybe even the more personal side of our journalists, their personalities, through our audio. You know, that's inevitably going to happen even by hearing their voice rather than just the written word. And I mean, the hope is that they will realise that that's someone they want to hear more from. If they've enjoyed their analysis or whatever it is, and that we can then direct them back to the website. You can get your first 30 days free access to the Telegraph.
Yeah,
so
I saw that,
there's really no excuse. Have you done it?
Not yet.
Okay, there's still time. So yes, it's a case of kind of showing, it's a little window into our offering. We are thinking about subscriber-only podcasts. I think everyone is at the moment thinking about how that could work. The technology is a little bit behind where we'd want it to be. It can be quite clunky to offer people subscriber-only content, because obviously subscribing on your regular podcast app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc., doesn't mean that you've paid us money anywhere. But there is definitely a role for us to grow subscriptions. It just might be leveraging the talent of our newsroom, showing off what we can do, and then guiding you back to paid subscription, more traditional platforms after that.
I guess The Athletic did that. They put free podcast content out to drive online subscriptions. So I think there's a strategy there. How important do you think, you just mentioned personalities, how important do you think personalities are in podcasts? You know, like Sir Brian Moore, who's a huge personality, or even, you know, politically, your own journalists like Chopper or whatever.
Yeah, I do think that personality is really important. Obviously, it depends on the kind of show that you're doing. But I think there's probably a reason why we stuck a whole load of our host names in the title of our shows. Yeah, as you said, we've got Brian Moore's for Contact. Christopher Hope, our chief political correspondent, his nickname is Chopper. He's Chopper of Chopper's Politics. And we've got Bryony Gordon's Mad World. I think it depends on the subject matter, doesn't it? Look, you're probably not going to go to a daily news bulletin for the personality, but you are going to go to something like Bryony Gordon's Mad World to hear Bryony really connect and empathise with her interviewees. She discusses mental health with prominent people who haven't necessarily discussed their struggles before. Mm. Politics, look, no one's going to say no to the odd lighter moment in a political podcast, not least because it can all get so serious. So yeah, showing a bit of personality is no bad thing. And also, you know, our journalists are very funny, clever people, and why would we hide that? There's a time and a place, but yeah, I definitely think it plays a role, and it is something that we think about when we're commissioning shows. I'd be lying if I said it wasn't.
So discoverability, to me, is one of the biggest problems, and particularly for publishers, but podcasting in general. Would you agree with that?
One of the biggest. I do think it's getting better. You know, we've got far more curated lists on podcast apps. You've got a good mix of bigger and smaller publishers. When Google introduced that search engine feature where you can now Google podcast about whatever, gardening, fishing, skipping, and it will come up with a list of shows. You know, if you think about how you would go around finding a new podcast, if you wanted a podcast about gardening, Googling it would be a pretty good way to go about it. I think it probably says a lot. On the flip side, it probably says a lot that there are lots of new platforms being set up to, in this kind of quest to become, dare I say it, the Netflix of podcasting, and to show off lots of other podcasts, you know, BBC Sounds being just one of them. Mm. So that probably says that there is still a big discoverability problem. I think it's getting better. It's not there yet. And that you have to be really proactive still about promoting your podcast. But I would put it to you, Peter, that monetization is the biggest issue or obstacle in podcasting.
Yeah, fair enough.
But yeah, discoverability is a huge issue.
So in terms of monetization, is that I know it's important. It's important for everything in media, but what comes first, driving maybe subscription revenues and audience engagement or actual full-on sponsorship?
For us, it's definitely driving subscription and engagement. I guess it depends whether you see your podcast as, if you are a subscriber-driven company like we are, do you see your podcast as a retention perk for people who are already subscribed?
Yeah.
Or do you see them as a way to drive subscriptions afresh? If it's purely the second, then I salute you. You're clearly doing something groundbreaking that no other publisher has ever thought of before, because it's just not as easy as that. I think most subscriber-only businesses or primarily subscriber businesses would definitely sit somewhere in between the two of those. But yeah, I mean, for us, look, we'd never make a show just because we've got the money for it. We'd make a show because we want to do it editorially and it fits well with our brand and we think it's worth doing. So it's not, if we get sponsorship, that's great, and that means we can put more resources into it and bring on more sound designers or producers or journalists, but it's not led by, we don't get big commercial pitches in that say, please make us a podcast about this. We lead with the show, and then if there's a commercial sponsor that fits and isn't jarring, then we'll go for that.
So as the Telegraph's first full-time podcast editor, do you see that role developing, you know, obviously more at the Telegraph? You've got someone starting soon, but in other publishing organisations, do you see it becoming more of a sort of feature?
Definitely. I mean, it used to be really quite rare to see these full-time podcast jobs coming up, and used to get the sort of podcast Twitterati, if we can call ourselves that, manically sharing them. It's becoming more common. Obviously, you know, you've got the rise of the Daily Show, and I think The Guardian have... I think it's 8 on their Daily Show. And that's just on one show alone, and they've got plenty of shows. So, the Daily Show is driving that. It's a different story, of course, but as we see audio growing in general, something like the Times Radio, I'd imagine we'll see lots more of those jobs coming up. So if you're looking, it's a good time.
So we always finish up by asking our guests for a media recommendation, or a podcast, a film, a magazine, a newspaper. Have you got anything for us?
I am completely obsessed and addicted to something, to a podcast which I'm sure many people have discovered before me, but it's Ear Hustle by Radiotopia. Do you know it?
I've never heard of it, no.
It is brilliant. So it's made inside, almost entirely inside a California prison, with a couple of Radiotopia producers who come in to help out. But it takes you kind of inside prison life. It's an all-male prison. They are really candid about what they get up to in there. They talk about finding love in prison, getting qualifications in prison, what they eat. I am really nosy, and so it appeals to me greatly. But also the sound design is just brilliant. I want them on my team.
Just a reminder, we are going to be doing our first ever live streamed Twitch podcast in 2 weeks' time. So that's Thursday, April the 9th at 2 p.m. British summer time. Thank you for the correction, BST. So yeah, if you want to join us for that, there's a post on our website at voices.media that's got the hyperlink to that. We'll be talking about publishing in a pandemic and basically the good side of how publishers are coping with the current crisis.
And you'll get to see my really confused face because I've never been on Twitch before.
You can find that at voices.media. While you're there, sign up to our weekly newsletter, which contains a link to the latest episode, links out to what we've been writing and what we've been reading from around the web.
And if you're bored, and we know you're bored because you've been stuck indoors for at least a week, you should follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod. Every day we'll be putting some nice stuff out there, some probably not so nice stuff, but it all be media focused.
But until next week, when we are going to be back, still sat inside waiting for this all to be over, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.
It's the end of the world as we know it.